From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, creating a preteen millionaire mastermind. We meet Owen Colfer, author of the Artemis Fowl series. The best-selling trio of children's novels are a combination of fantasy, fairy tale, and police thriller. Also, we talk with the Tony-nominated British comedy team of Foley and McCall. Together, they're known as The Right Size. They describe their current Broadway show, The Play What I Wrote, as a hectic collision of comic styles from slapstick, vaudeville, and variety shows. And since everyone's curious about the much-anticipated sequel to The Matrix, our film critic David Edelstein reviews The Matrix Reloaded. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Authorities in Texas have charged a New York-based trucker with transporting illegal immigrants after 18 Mexican and Central American migrants died yesterday after being crammed into an overheated trailer in South Texas. They say the trucker, Tyrone Williams, admitted to taking $2,500 to smuggle 16 illegal immigrants through Texas, though as many as 100 were later crowded into the trailer. Ana Yanez Correa heads a Latino civil rights group in Austin. She says the U.S. should be aware of the needs that drive migrants to risk their lives.
People are so desperate to have a decent pay so they can send money back to their family that they are willing to risk their lives. And as you can see in Texas, many of them do die.
Meanwhile, in Arizona, a humanitarian aid group is set to establish water stations for illegal migrants in the desert, where temperatures are expected to top 100 degrees this weekend. Mark Moran reports from member station KJZZ in Phoenix.
Arizona's southern Sonoran Desert now has the dubious distinction of being the most likely spot for a Hispanic migrant to die while trying to enter the United States illegally on foot. Last year, at least 136 people died there. The U.S. Border Patrol has stationed more agents in and around border towns, which has forced migrants into the most remote and dangerous stretches of the desert to attempt to cross. That's where a humanitarian aid group called Samaritans on Patrol will be erecting water stations marked with blue flags atop 30-foot aluminum poles for migrants who get lost and dehydrated during their trek. Samaritans on Patrol is affiliated with Tucson's Southside Presbyterian Church, which was raided for its involvement in a national sanctuary movement involving migrant workers in the 1960s. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
A group of FBI agents has arrived in Saudi Arabia to help investigate the bombings of Western housing compounds in Riyadh. U.S. officials have complained that Saudi officials gave little cooperation in prior investigations. The U.S. ambassador said today he expects better cooperation this time. Paul Bremer, the new civil administrator of Iraq, concedes that security is a major problem in the country. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports from Baghdad that Bremer has promised to increase the U.S. troop presence on the streets.
He said that they'd made 300 arrests in the last 48 hours. He also said that they've increased the number of patrols by coalition forces, by U.S. forces in Baghdad. And Baghdad is apparently the worst spot for crime right now. So he's made promises, but of course, Jay Garner, his predecessor, made lots of promises along those lines. And as far as most Iraqis are concerned, this still remains their number one priority, and they're going to want to see evidence of a change quickly.
NPR's Christopher Joyce in Baghdad. In stocks, the Dow gained 65 points to close at 87.13. This is NPR News. The U.S. Coast Guard said today that it intercepted six Cubans who were trying to reach Florida in a small boat. Coast Guard officials said all six tried to evade capture by jumping into the water, but eventually gave up after treading water for as much as 2 hours. The U.S. generally returns would-be migrants to Cuba if they're intercepted at sea. Those who manage to reach shore are usually permitted to stay. Two of the three Cuban men who did manage to swim ashore earlier this month appeared today in court in Key West. They were charged with assaulting Coast Guard members who tried to detain them at sea. The Senate has approved a proposal to boost Medicare payments to rural health care providers. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
Senators voted 86-12 to add the health provisions to the tax bill. The proposal by Finance Committee Chairman Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, could increase payments for rural hospitals, home health agencies, and others by as much as $25 billion over the next 10 years. But the plan is controversial. Grassley would pay for the rural increases by requiring Medicare patients to pay for part of their laboratory tests, by freezing fees for durable medical equipment like walkers and wheelchairs, and by lowering Medicare payments for the few outpatient drugs the program currently covers. Urban health care providers who are hoping to win increases when Congress takes up broader Medicare legislation next month are also likely to be unhappy. But Grassley acted on this bill to preempt Iowa Democratic Senator Tom Harkin, who threatened to offer his own amendment. Julie Rovner, NPR News, The Capitol.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 16 points, or 1%, to close at 1,551. The S&P 500 gained 7 to close at 946. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. My guest is the author of a series of internationally best-selling fantasy novels for children about a young boy and magic. No, I'm not talking about Harry Potter. It's the other one, Artemis Fowl, by the Irish writer Owen Colfer. Artemis Fowl is a 12-year-old millionaire, a genius, and a criminal mastermind. He discovers a hidden fairy kingdom, a gritty urban underground more akin to Blade Runner than the wee people of Irish lore. Fowl infiltrates their world looking for gold. One critic likens the stories to Tom Clancy with pixie dust. Miramax Studios is currently developing a film of the first book. The third book in the series is just out, Artemis Fowl, The Eternity Code. Owen Colfer is the author of a number of other children's books. Until recently, he was also a schoolteacher in Ireland. I asked him to read from the beginning of his new book. In this scene, our hero, Artemis, is in a restaurant waiting for his business contact. Even though Artemis looks like a boy, he acts very much like a sarcastic 30-year-old. When the waitress asks if he wants chicken nuggets and chips, he has a very sharp answer for her.
A waitress wandered over, smiling a dazzling smile. Hello there, young man. Would you like to see the children's menu? A vein pulsed in Artemis's temple. No, mademoiselle, I would not like to see the children's menu. I have no doubt that the children's menu itself tastes better than the meals on it. I would like to order a la carte, or don't you serve fish to minors? The waitress's smile shrunk by a couple of molars. Artemis's vocabulary had that effect on most people. Butler rolled his eyes. And Artemis wondered who would want to kill him. Most of the waiters and tailors in Europe, for a start. Yes, sir, stammered the unfortunate waitress. Whatever you like. What I would like is a medley of shark and swordfish, pan-seared, on a bed of julienne vegetables and new potatoes. And to drink? Spring water, Irish if you have it, and no ice, please, as your ice is no doubt made from tap water, which rather defeats the purpose of spring water. The waitress scurried to the kitchen, relieved to escape from the pale youth at table 6. She'd seen a vampire movie once. The undead creature had the very same hypnotic stare. Maybe the kid spoke like a grown-up because he was actually 500 years old.
Now that's Owen Colfer reading from his new book. It's called Artemis Fowl, The Eternity Code, and it's third in his Artemis Fowl series. Owen Colfer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Thanks for the reading, too. You started writing about fairies. And fairies do play a big part in these books.
No, they do. I suppose it's the Irish culture. I mean, we have a very strong history of storytelling, and a lot of those stories involve the arcane and magic and fairies. And the legend goes that when Irish people, humans, first arrived in Ireland on the island, they had to fight a great battle against the fairy folk the day down, and they drove them underground, and that's where they still live. And everything bad is attributed to them, and all good luck is also attributed to them. So it was quite natural for me to write about fairies. There are hundreds of Irish fairy books.
The thing I like about the fairy kingdom in your books is that they seem to answer some questions that you might have about fairies if you're a kid hearing these stories for the first time? For instance, why do they live underground? How can they live underground? And how they manage living underground? Were these some of the things you thought about when you were hearing the legends as a child?
It was, and as we all know, children are the most inquisitive creatures on the planet, and every second word is why. And my own son, who's 5 now, he's entered that phase, and you can't just tell him anything. You have to explain it and its history back to, you know, the Jurassic days. He wants every detail, and he's not satisfied until he has it. And when I was reading these fairy stories, even as a 6 or 7 year old, I said, couldn't happen. You know, why are they there? How can they survive? You know, what are they eating? Mud, you know? So I decided to make this plausible for kids, because once you satisfy those questions and answer those questions, kids will accept it. They'll say, okay. And they know it's not true, but they'll pretend to believe it for that 20 minutes they're reading. So that's what I wanted to do, set it up so well that kids could suspend their disbelief for a while.
The other thing I love about these fairies is the fairy kingdom is that they have a very highly advanced technology. And it really turns that whole idea of the wee little people with their quaint little ways on its head.
Well, that was the only way I reckon kids would believe that fairies could have stayed hidden for so long. I mean, if we're so clever, why haven't we found them? Because they're smarter. And that's the only way they would stay hidden. And so, but once you get that idea and you begin to draw parallels between the human and fairy world, basically you just take our world and you add 100 years and you see what could be possible. And all the gadgets and the gimmicks, they could happen. You know, it could work. I don't like when I go to a movie and there's ridiculous gadgets, you know, that it couldn't possibly work. Then that turns me off the movie. If I believe that it is possible, if you go to a movie like Blade Runner and you say, okay, well, the world could be like this in a couple of 100 years. Everything here, there's nothing ridiculous, except for the human robots. But ignoring the humanoid robots, there's nothing ridiculous. But if you go to a movie and they've got kind of shrink rays, you know, that, you know, shrink people down, you're just going, oh, forget it. This is just ridiculous. So I like to really research the gadgets and make them all kind of believable.
Now, you describe the books as a diehard with fairies.
Yeah.
That must be a quote that's come back to haunt you.
In a way, I was very unmedia savvy, which I still am, but I was extremely green at that time. It was about, I suppose, 3 years ago, and it was the very first or second interview I had done, and he said, could you describe it in a movie? Like, what movie is it like? And so I said it was a bit like Die Hard with fairies, but more for the attitude. I really liked the attitude of that movie because it didn't take itself seriously. And it was funny as well as being very exciting. And the villain was way over the top. And it was all completely ridiculous, but done in such a way that you utterly believed it for the hour and a half you were watching it. So that's what I liked about it. Obviously, the plot is not very similar, but it was just the attitude.
Well, there is a good bit of violence in your books. Yeah. There are guns and there are explosives, and Artemis Fowl has a bodyguard who does do a lot of damage. But it's all kind of along the lines of Pow and Sako and karate kicks to the temple.
I call it the A-team violence. You know, you remember the A-team, you know, 200 bullets get fired, but no one gets hit. And, you know, a car crashes off a cliff, but they make sure to show you everyone climbing out. And I'm kind of like that. I give a lot of detail about stuff, but no one really gets hurt and nobody dies. And it's because you do have to be a bit responsible. In the second book, I do kill 4 lizards. I will put my hand up and say, yes, I did kill those lizards, but they had it coming, you know. And they were named after my brothers and they definitely had it coming. So I think I can be forgiven for that.
Well, I was going to ask you if you did have a rule about it, because it seems as if after 10 minutes, everyone always gets up.
Yeah, I know it's a bit hokey, but hopefully the tension and, you know, I don't do it too often. For example, in the first book, I think there's like 3 fights or something. So it's not as if someone gets shot every minute. And I try to build a tension in such a way that it could happen. It could be someone could die. And I mean, once you think someone is dead, and so I think I give you the thrill of killing someone off, but then I cheat and bring him back. So, but in the third book, in the book I'm working on now, there will be a few fatalities, but I still don't want to kill any humans. I'm very fond of our species. I don't want to kill any of us. But I mean, I think if you're handling very serious issues, you have to respect them. If you're going to write about death you have to respect it, you know, and you have to give it what it's due, because there are going to be kids reading this who have lost family, and you don't want to casually kill someone's father, and it, you know, it could really hurt that kid.
So I have to ask you, had you read the Harry Potter books before you started writing the world?
I hadn't. Obviously, I knew about the Harry Potter books. I mean, unless you were living, you know, under a rock down a cave somewhere with earplugs, you would have heard of those. But I hadn't read them. And I was in, my book had just come out, and I was in London for some interviews, and there was a big banner headline on some newspaper, "Is this the next Harry Potter?" And I said, "Oh my God, my book is the same as Harry Potter's. What have I done?" So I went and bought Harry Potter in the bookstore in the train station, and sitting on the train, I read it, and I was very much relieved to find out that it wasn't the next Harry Potter. And then all the journalists read it, and the next headline was, "Is this the anti-Harry Potter?" So I just can't win. You know? If I'm not Harry Potter, well, then I'm the opposite of Harry Potter. Somehow Harry Potter is getting into the equation. But, you know, I can't really complain, because I think people have picked up my book on the strength of that. And a lot of those people have stayed with me and bought the next book. So, you know, next time I see old J.K. Rowling, I'll buy her a pint of Guinness or something. Or maybe she can buy me one. She probably has more money.
What kind of fan mail do you get from kids?
I get fan mail from everybody, boys, girls, grown-ups, teenagers. And often I get fan mail in code, because there's a code running along the bottom of one of the books.
And a fairy code.
A fairy code called Gnomish. And if you decode that, there's a little story in there, a little prophecy. It's just another dimension to the book. And so people often write to me in code, pages and pages. It must take them hours. So I'm...
Do you decode it?
Oh, yes. I decode every single word. But I'm praying as I open the envelope, you know, please God, English. But generally, I do try to decode it. It's taken them so long to do it. I mean, they're actually, each little one, it's a work of art, you know. And these kids, they're fantastic, but... I love that kind of thing. When I was young, I was in a spy club, and you decode stuff every week, and I always loved that. So, but that's taken off. There are whole websites dedicated to this code, and people communicate in code, and, you know, very smart kids. And I try to answer it all, but sometimes it's 3 months before I get it from the publishers, and then another 2 months before I can get around to it. So,
and do you answer in code?
No, there's a little bit of code. There is, because I have the font now. You can download the font, so you can just type in English, and code comes out.
Uh-huh.
I should actually. That'd teach him.
How did you write the code in the first place? And was that fun?
I didn't come up with the symbols. In the book, the story says that the code is based on hieroglyphics, or rather, hieroglyphics is based on the code. So that's where the Egyptians got their language from, fairies, which is not true, obviously, but it's nice for the purpose. It fits into my story. So they got this hieroglyphics expert in London. And he devised a font, because it's just a font, really. It's not a language, based very loosely on hieroglyphics, but also adding in things like computer chips to show that it's a very modern society. So he ran it across. There's a code for every book now. And if you want to learn more about the codes and keep up with the latest code developments, then you can go to my website, which is just owencalfer.com.
I'm talking with Owen Colfer. He is the author of the international best-selling series Artemis Fowl. It's about a 12-year-old criminal mastermind. Colfer's third book in the series is just out. It's called Artemis Fowl, The Eternity Code. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is children's book author Owen Colfer. He has a new installment in his Artemis Fowl series. It's about a boy genius who masterminds international crime and discovers a technologically advanced fairy kingdom. His new book, the third in this series, is Artemis Fowl, The Eternity Code. Artemis Fowl, the first book, is being made into a movie.
Yeah.
Are you involved in that?
No, I'm not, because I absolutely don't have time. Oh, and I wasn't asked. But besides that, I probably wouldn't have time anyway. Apparently, it's all set to go, and they have the script done, and they're now wrangling about the budget, so to see who they can afford to cast.
So, how will the casting work? And I would imagine you're Irish. You'd like to have an Irish actor.
I would love to have an Irish actor. There was a casting agent in Ireland looking for Artemis, going around to the schools, but that was like 2 years ago, and now whoever they found is too old, so they're going to have to do it again. I think there are a few child actors that they're looking at that would be kind of well known, but I think they'll have to see how they do with the Irish accent. I think there's nothing worse than, I don't know how that goes in America, but when an Irish person turns on Far and Away, they go, oh my God.
That must be so painful.
Except for, you have to say it, Nicole Kidman, who had a brilliant Irish accent. But in Tom, in fairness to him, you could hear the Mission Impossible team playing behind his head as he was giving it the Irish. But if you're listening, Tom, sorry. But our Dick Van Dyke doing a London accent, that's another one of our favourites. But these days, I think they're much more conscious of that. And, you know, you get actors who really go all out. Liam Neeson does a very good Irish accent, but, you know, sometimes...
I wonder why.
Colin Farrell does a good Irish accent. Yeah, but, so hopefully they'll get someone who can either act or is Irish.
Never both.
Or both, yeah, that'd be good.
Just one more question about the movie.
Yeah.
The fairies. Now, yeah. I would think that you might have some concerns about it, about what Hollywood could get most wrong about fairies. For instance, buckled shoes and knickers.
Yes. Yeah, I'm a bit worried about that, you know. Put up your hands, Bigara. No, that could be a bit, or I'll shake this pointy head at you. That's worrying. But I think what sold them on this was the whole high-tech fairy thing. And they were very intrigued by that. And I've seen some of the drawings that they did, and they really look, you know, these guys look cool. You know, they don't look hokey at all. So
it's kind of the Matrix with fairies.
Yeah, it could be, you know, kind of the Matrix with fairies, but with good dialogue. That's what I'm hoping. So not that the Matrix hasn't got good dialogue. It does. I actually like the Matrix. But good snappy dialogue between the fairies and not the usual, oh, my God, there, sure, here's a wish for you now. Would you not like a bit of gold? none of that. An actual dialogue.
I'm talking with Owen Colfer. He's the author of the Artemis Fowl series of children's books. They're about a 12-year-old criminal mastermind, Artemis Fowl. His third book in the series is just out. It's called Artemis Fowl, The Eternity Code. As a kid, did you read series of books like this? I'm thinking of Narnia.
Oh, yeah. I read all the... I loved the Narnia books, and I loved the Lord of the Rings books, and... There were several other fantasy series I loved. Raymond E. Feist magician series and Stephen Donaldson, Thomas Covenant series. There was loads of them. And I went through a real phase with four or five friends of mine in our teens, and we read every fantasy book on the market. And I just loved them, and they were kind of like a reliable thing. You knew what you were going to get in these, and. And everybody, you want to be uniform. I think when you're a kid, you want to be accepted in some area, whether it's sports or drama or academia. But for me, it was this fantasy thing and music, heavy metal music and fantasy, which kind of go together. So it was AC/DC and Lord of the Rings, strangely enough. And they were the ones that... And I was in the club, and that was it. All I had to do was get a denim jacket, and you're in, you know. So you don't have to be funny. You just say, hey, dude... That's it. No wit required. So, it's. But also, I mean, there's a genuine love of literature there underneath, I think, for all these kids. And as it was for me, you can't survive on needing to be part of the group forever. I mean, you can pretend you like a certain band and then not listen to them, but you've got to read the books. You can't really fake it, you know. You can't say, I read Lord of the Rings, and if you haven't, because you'll be very quickly found out. So... You have to love the books, but it does give you that feeling of belonging. Nowadays, it's much more common. You see, in those days, there weren't as many readers as there are now. And if there were, they didn't say anything because it wasn't cool. You know, you didn't sit at the sidelines of the football game discussing Lemony Snicket. You know, it didn't happen. But now kids are swapping books in the open. What's going on? You know, their parents would bring them to book readings and signings. But in 20 years ago, that didn't really happen. So it's a brave new world out there, you know.
Now, is music still a part of your experience then, writing?
Oh, yes. I always play music when I'm writing, and very varied tastes. I love everything from AC/DC to Metallica.
Well, that covers a lot.
No, I'm just kidding. I like everything. And I mean, some of the modern stuff is great. I love Sheryl Crow. I think she's brilliant. And Coldplay are an excellent band, and Semisonic and all these wonderful bands. I do admit that I'm leaning towards guitar bands, but as I get older, I'm mellowing slightly. I haven't gone to see a heavy metal concert since Whitesnake. Back in, I don't know, 90-something. So once they started getting perms, I got out of heavy metal. I said, here.
That's where you
the
draw
frizzy
the line.
Perms, the loose shag, no, thank you. So if they have their own hair, I don't care, but no perms, please.
Well, Owen Colfer, it was really fun talking to you today.
It's my pleasure, Barbara.
Owen Colfer's new Artemis Fowl novel is called The Eternity Code. Noel Redding, the bass player for the Jimi Hendrix Experience, was found dead at his home in Ireland earlier this week. He was 57 years old. Redding played with Hendrix for 3 years in the late 60s. He also led his own bands, including Fat Mattress and the Noel Redding Band. Here's something from Axis, Bold as Love, the second Experience album, recorded in 1967. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Standing here freezing inside your golden garden. I've got my ladder leaned up against your wall. Tonight's the night we plan to run away together. Come on, jolly me, there's no time to stall. But now you're telling me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Harcourt, publisher of Odd Girl Out by Rachel Simmons, about the hidden culture of female bullying and cruelty among girls and how people can help. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the neo-vaudevillian duo of Sean Foley and Hamish McCall. They're known as The Right Size, and their Tony-nominated Broadway production is called The Play What I Wrote. And another Neo, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Matrix Reloaded.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. It's silly, it's goofy, it's even stupid in a brilliant sort of way, and it's just been nominated for a Tony, the Broadway play, The Play What I Wrote. It stars the British comedy duo The Right Size, made up of my guests, Sean Foley and Hamish McCall. They sing, they dance, they fall down, they do heart-stoppingly bad jokes, classic slapstick, and musical skits, all without a trace of irony. Oh yes, and then there's the plot. Foley and McCall play a comedy team in crisis. Hamish believes he's a serious playwright and wants to leave the double act. Sean, the rubber-legged funny man, wants to keep the act going. With the help of his sidekick, Arthur, Sean humors Hamish into believing they will indeed stage his awful play, set during the French Revolution. This provides the opportunity for the show's hook. Each evening, a mystery guest celebrity takes a role in the Bastille scene of the play within a play. Guests have included Nathan Lane, Glenn Close, Kevin Klein, and Roger Moore. The play What I Wrote is inspired by a legendary British double act, Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise, who hosted TV variety shows in the 60s and 70s, watched by everyone from bus drivers to the Windsors. Just to emphasize how hard it is to nail down the style of this show, it's been nominated for a Tony in the category of Best Special Theatrical Event. I'd like to talk about language, and I have to admit I have all these notes from the play about puns, but I can't read anything I wrote. I think I was laughing too hard. And also, the play moves along so quickly, I never finished anything. The only line that survived is one that I believe Hamish says. It's in the dreadful play within a play, his serious play, A Tight Squeeze for the Scarlet Pimple, which takes place, of course, during the French Revolution. And Hamish, you're draped in a French flag, and you're wearing a tiny Eiffel Tower on your head, and you say, now, if I say it, it's not going to be funny. I know.
Don't ask me to say it. I don't get funny until 8 p.m. every evening.
You say, I am France, and parts of me are revolting. I camembert it.
Yeah.
Now, that...
Discuss.
Discuss with reference to the French Revolution. Well, it was actually first said by Marat when Charlotte Corday wouldn't pass him the soap.
I have no question about this. No, what process do you go through in writing to come up with puns like that? Is that a line that you had to hone or revise, or did you add the camembert part later as you were goofing around?
That line came about, yes, that was actually... one of the sections that was slightly tweaked for the New York show. So that wasn't the Hamish with his flag and his Eiffel Tower wasn't in the London show. But yes, in answer to where did we make that material, we made it up in the Manhattan Theatre Club when we were goofing around trying to find what we needed. And believe me, there were other gags suggested and probably tried, and those were the ones that were the best, and they honed well and they sit well with the audience, and they are as absurd as they are awful lines, and they're the permanent excuse and deflating point for the audience is that this is you're allowed to do bad jokes because they are written by a man who thinks he is brilliant. Hamish the playwright is the worst writer who has ever lived, and he has written these absurdly bad lines, and you know, that gives a certain license for you to do them. If you really were doing them utterly straight up an evening of that, then I think you might have a harder time. But there is a sort of perspective in the story, which is that this one character really is not blessed with any writing skill at all.
So you kind of come in through the back door there. And then...
Well, at the same time as you may well be inclined to laugh at silly and stupid jokes like that, you're also very much more inclined to laugh at a person, a character, who believes that what they're doing is wonderful and great, and that they are the new Arthur Miller Light. And which Hamish does, and it's therefore you're laughing at the character as well as the joke, and that's always a much stronger laugh, I think, to get. And that's, you know, that brings us back to the show. I mean, all sorts of comedy is employed, and as you say, there's slapstick, there's physical comedy, there's visual and verbal puns, there's comedy with the set, but underneath it all is, in fact, a story going on, that you're watching a story which sustains, we think anyway, that amount of sort of frothy comedy is sustained by the fact that actually you are watching, in process, a little conflict going on, a drama, a story, of these two guys, and will they patch it up and keep working together, or will indeed Hamish leave to become this great writer, as he thinks?
Now, there's also a bit, a good deal of the play is a reference to comedy, and there is a scene where you, Sean, are trying to console Hamish about his ability or his lack of ability to get laughs, and you talk about the delayed laugh and the anticipatory laugh, and the most sophisticated laugh of all, the inaudible laugh. Now, those first two laughs really, I don't know about the inaudible one, but they do exist. I mean, doing what you do, you must have a whole category, a slew of categories for different kinds of laughs. Is that true?
Well, we do. I mean, but those are taken to extremes. The delayed laugh. Hamish's character says, you know, that he doesn't understand how when he says something, nobody laughs, and then Sean says something, and everybody laughs. And that, it is described to him that that is the delayed laugh, because people what I say is so funny that people go into shock and that they aren't able to laugh until actually after it's till Sean says something. Indeed, you know, those are absurd ones, but we are, precise, I think I'd say. Not so much in terms of the kind of laughs, but how to get them. I mean, we have Ken Branagh, who directed this show, who we hadn't known before, and when he came into rehearsals was amazed and never ceased to tease us about the language with it, which we use for... How to best affect a laugh in the audience. We're constantly talking about things like holding it up, which means that if you go at it, holding it up for us means that you're going for the punchline, but you can't put the punchline too quickly in. So you might put a phrase like "by the way" or
"well anyway,"
which would just hold it up and then you deliver the punchline, because the analysis would be that without that, the punchline comes too quick and you're not getting the best of the laugh. The other one would be like, we call it like studying it, which means that if you're aiming at a punchline in 3 lines time, is it just how many times do we share the preceding lines before we go for the punchline? And a line is a stud. So Sean might say to me, for this line, I need you to stud me there, which would mean...
You could just say something as simple as "what," or you say "when," or whatever it is. It's just, as Hamish says, it's literally the science of when you are delivering the thing at which you want everyone to laugh, to get the most effect from your material.
So it might be highly efficient, for example, not to get the audience laughing for during a build. A rhythmical build, because then when you do release the laughter, you get a much bigger laugh at the end. Whereas if they've laughed sort of consistently and irregularly throughout the build, your punchline laugh will never be as big. As I'm saying this, I can just hear how obsessive this thing is.
I can hear people falling asleep.
wake up, America.
Wake up, everyone.
Wake up, America.
Interesting, but only to a very, very few people.
Ronnie Corbett, as a great English comedian, said, "You talk about comedy at your peril, because the minute you do it, it starts to unravel in your hands." And I think it's a mercurial thing. It doesn't really make much sense to talk about it in any really empirical sense. It's intuitive, really.
Well, moving on, every performance features a mystery guest who agrees to perform in Hamish's overwritten and overacted play and perform in period costume. Were the mystery guests part of this old variety show format? Upon that?
They're exactly right. They Morecambe and Wise in their television series. They would have a mystery guest, you know, every week, and they would be, because they were such huge British TV stars then at that point, they would get people like truly great actors, like, you know, Laurence Olivier would come on and be, I think you say it here, sort of lightly roasted, you know, teased to within an inch of his life about how bad he was as an actor and, you know, why couldn't he deliver these great lines better than what he was doing. You know, they even had... our Prime Minister at the time, Harold Wilson, on one of their shows. So they were that big. But that is where the idea comes from, that the guest star would, as happens in our show, the guest star turns up desperately. Sean has promised Hamish that, you know, to try and keep the evening going, because he doesn't want Hamish to leave, he said that he will do his play, and that, indeed, there is a guest star turning up to do it, when he knows full well that there isn't in his mind. But then, miraculously, you know, Liam Neeson will turn up, or Nathan Lane will turn up, or Glenn Close will turn up, or Jeff Goldblum will turn up, all people we've had in the show so far, amongst others, and John Lithgow has done it as well, and they will turn up to be to take their role as the Count de Toblerone in Hamish's French Revolution masterpiece, A Tight Squeeze for the Scarlet Pimple.
Well, what are some of the roasting or teasing of prominent guest stars that you're most proud of?
We adored teasing Sting when he did it. He had a line which we asked him to say, that he was delighted to be there, but would we please not take the Mickey out of any of his song lyrics, which we then peppered the entire show with. Of course, it was constantly stop the show, there's a message for you, Sting, it's in a bottle. There was all every little thing you're doing is magic.
Don't stand so close to me, Sting.
And it was that was just wonderful. But in general, everywhere, I mean, Liam Neeson, Sean thinks for the entire length of the play is Leslie Nielsen. You know, they're sort of absurdly light, but they're extremely efficient ways of teasing people. And I think that it's got an enormous comic richness to it.
Now, Kenneth Branagh, your director, he was also a mystery guest one night. How did he do?
He did very well, except he did forget his very first line, which is when he comes on, he has to say his first line is, "I am Ken Branagh." And he, due to large amounts of nerves and a certain sense of surreal that he was in the show that he had been directing, that was something that we were able to tease him about for months. But he did very well. He's quite a good actor, actually.
Who would have guessed?
He did not too bad, not too bad. People were quite pleased to see him on stage, yeah.
Sean Foley and Hamish McCall are my guests. They're a comedy team known as The Right Size. They're currently starring on Broadway in their new play, The Play What I Wrote. We're going to take a break now, Sean and Hamish, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sean Foley and Hamish McCall. Together they make up the British comedy team The Right Size. They're performing on Broadway in a vaudeville-type full-length comedy called The Play What I Wrote. How did you two meet?
We met romantically enough in Paris in 1986, I think, or 7, where we were both studying at a theatre school run by a man called Philippe Gaulier. And we were there for the long and rich period of 1 month before we ran out of money, and we came back to England together. And during that time of that in Paris, we had made each other laugh and we had improvised really well on stage together, and we thought, yeah, let's start doing work. So we started doing cabarets and hat fairs and summer fairs and anything, and, you know, just comic shtick, really. And then after that, we developed a fully-fledged company. In 1988, we made our first show, Quaisera. And we've been touring the world with shows like that, and very much comedy theatre shows, for the last 15 years.
You did tour all over the world. I think I read you were in Oman for a performance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were there cultural differences in I mean, was that a memorable performance? Yeah. Your gig.
The Oman. It was It was an extremely successful evening, but it was, yeah, very, very different. I mean, but they're extremely cultured people, and they very much enjoy laughing. So it was great. I mean, we've played in places where, like in West Africa, when we played there, we played in Ghana and places like that. And even when we played in Oman, actually, when we played outside the central, the main city, the biggest difference is that they don't have a strong sense of the delineation between audience and performer. So you have a lot of interaction with people calling out to you, or maybe even coming to visit you on stage. You know, it's a much more movable.
There's no history of theatre in that sense of. There's a stage and we go in and we pay the money and we sit down and just we take what they give us on stage. That it was sort of like we're all in this big room together, you know, why don't we just all do what everyone else does, you know?
Yeah.
We were doing a show called Flight to Finland, which was all set on a boat, and every time we'd sort of try and portray or imagine or suggest that there were seagulls overhead, people would really, really react like there were seagulls overhead, or they'd really react like...
And create their own seagulls in you know, or they'd wave... Sean would wave out at some as a ship left an imaginary port, and everybody would stand up and wave back at him.
So it was a real collaboration.
Because it was just, you know, it's just sort of...
God knows how we haven't got through the show.
But, I mean, it was just a completely different show, but they had a great time, you know, and it's, I think that one of the sort of things that we learned during that was that, you know, you have to keep very loose and easy on your material and not get uptight about it, because they're doubtlessly having a great, great time, but just they're not having the time that you would expect them to have, or not in the way that you would expect them to be having it.
Now, did you actually research old routines from vaudeville halls or look up old vaudeville players?
Well, we've come at sort of, you know, getting hold of that material and reinventing it, as it were, from lots of sources. Just simply some, you know, old films you might see, or indeed classic films. You know, Buster Keaton is a hero of both of ours. You know, as are Laurel and Hardy and some of the great silent comedians. That's their work is still current and still wonderful. Then you have the people over here, like you had Bert Lahr, and we had over in Britain, you know, our musical stars, Max Wall, and his sort of array of funny walks comes to mind, which, you know, then in the generation after that was Monty Python and their Ministry of Silly Walks, which was, you know, essentially that old tradition of what was called eccentric dancing put in a new form and a new sketch and represented as lots of types of comedy are.
Now, tell me if this is too personal, but are either one of you married or in a serious relationship? And
oh,
I ask
God,
that.
Barbara,
too personal.
Don't ask us
too
that.
Personal.
I mean, that is
I'm
outrageous.
So sorry. I can't believe it. She sounded such a nice lady, didn't she?
And then bang, like that. Grubbing around, trying to get the dirt. I'm married, yes, two kids.
Uh-huh. I'm married, yes, one kid.
Well, very good. So I thought that would be such a problem with a double act. That was a classic. Once you get married and other people enter into the mix, were there any bumps?
Well, this is where the people often say that a double act is like a marriage, don't they, Sean?
Yeah, and it's absolutely absurd, isn't it, darling?
I mean, the thing is, we work together, but I mean, many people who, you know, Ben and Jerry make ice cream together. I mean, and I don't know whether they're married, but they presumably have other lives. There's a sort of conception with double acts that you're sort of that you are in some way married or impossibly close. I mean, we work together, we tour together, but we go home, we have other lives. We don't socialise together anymore, because we used to do that a lot in the old days, and we have our families to go home to. You know, it's not that much different than a normal business. You know, we are business partners, and then we have our
You make
families.
It sound so romantic.
I'm weeping.
Yeah.
Well, Sean Foley and Hamish McCall, I want to thank you very much for allowing me to put you
Enter
through this dissection
world.
Of your comedy.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Barbara, although I'm still smarting about that personal question you asked.
Sean Foley and Hamish McCall star in the Broadway show The Play What I Wrote. It's been nominated for a Tony. Coming up, The Matrix Reloaded. This is Fresh Air. The science fiction thriller The Matrix was not only one of the biggest hits of 1999, it won a huge cult following for its fusion of existential philosophy, great martial arts, and groundbreaking special effects. The Wachowski brothers, who wrote and directed the film, took 4 years to make the second part of their Matrix trilogy, The Matrix Reloaded, and now there are lines around the block at your neighborhood multiplexes. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Okay, don't shoot the messenger. For one thing, I can't make bullets freeze in midair like Keanu Reeves as everybody's favorite computer geek turned messianic superhero, Neo, a.k.a. The One. For another, I'm on the side of Joe Moviegoer. I wanted The Matrix Reloaded to be just as religious an experience as the original. Let's say a word about that original before the really bad news. The Matrix was, above all, a kind of ontological mystery. How could Carrie Ann Moss, in that slinky black vinyl cat suit, suspend herself in midair, karate kick some guard, then scamper horizontally along the wall? Who were those dudes in the sunglasses and identical suits? Why did Neo's life feel so unreal? The answers first bent your mind, and then they blew it. They were all in a giant computer simulation, devised by machines to drain the energy from humans in a state of suspended animation. Okay, it sounds dumb, but the Wachowski brothers, Andy and Larry, exploited everything smart and trendy in postmodern science fiction and wedded it to everything smart and trendy in postmodern philosophy. They even gave a cameo to a book by Jean Baudrillard. Then they mixed in up-to-the-minute digital effects and Hong Kong martial arts so that each action scene was like an ontological, metaphysical leap forward. Plus, the movie kicked butt. So here's the word on the sequel. It stinks. It's an ugly, overblown, repetitive movie that builds to a punchline that should have come an hour earlier, then it ends when it should be getting going, with a teaser for Part 3, The Matrix Revolutions, coming in November to 8,000 theaters near you. Almost from the start, this one feels different. It's full of sequences that should be the coolest things ever, but they feel more like video games that can reset themselves when they're done. One ballyhooed sequence is entirely digital. It shows Neo fighting more than 100 incarnations of his old nemesis, Agent Smith. He sends one somersaulting into the far distance, does a backflip onto a wall, and sends another few in the direction of the camera, which is dive-bombing and swirling and whooshing around at speeds that would tear an ordinary camera apart. It looks real, but it doesn't have the impact of the real. Maybe that's because the minimal plot of this thing is essentially a video game. Neo goes back into the Matrix to find someone called the Keymaker, who can take him to the source, the inner core of the simulated universe. Each new level presents more kung fu adversaries and more fearsome obstacles. And if you're a champ, you get to the source. Now, Neo is a champ. He can even fly. The other characters joke that he's like Superman, but he's more like Super Priest. His long coat has been replaced by a black hassock with a high cleric's collar. He's a bulletproof monk. The Matrix is basically his playpen. He can look the way he wants, move the way he wants. He might even be able to bring back the dead. But his powers don't seem to turn him on. Neo is a dull, earnest kind of messiah, and Carrie Ann Moss's Trinity has lost that mysterioso S&M vibe and become rather mushy and maternal. It doesn't help that the pair get stuck for a while in the underground city of Zion, which is like a rusting shopping mall in hell. It's where all the unplugged humans go to plan their guerrilla uprisings against the machines. And here's an intriguing surprise. Most of them are African-American, Asian, or mixtures of sundry other races. And here's a depressing surprise. Listen to Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus and Jada Pinkett Smith as Niobe, all good actors. Sound like the cast of Star Trek Deep Space Nine on a really bad day.
The machines are digging. They're boring from the surface straight down to Zion.
Mother.
They'll avoid the entire perimeter defense.
How fast are they moving?
Control estimates their descent at 100 meters an hour.
How deep are they?
Almost 2,000 meters.
What about the scans from the Osiris?
They can't be accurate.
They may be.
What?
It's not possible.
That'd mean there are 250,000 sentinels up there.
That's right.
That can't be.
Why not? A sentinel for every man, woman, and child in Zion.
That sounds exactly like the thinking of a machine to me.
Morpheus, glad you could join us.
Niobe. My apologies to all. As you are undoubtedly aware, it has become increasingly difficult to locate a secure broadcast position.
Squiddy's got all our best spots.
Mainline is crawling with them.
And if Niobe's right, in 72 hours, it's going to be 250,000 more.
What are we going to do about it?
We're going to do what Commander Locke ordered us to do. We'll evacuate broadcast level and return to Zion.
And does the commander have a plan for stopping 250,000 sentinels?
A strategy is still being formulated.
Dull staging, tinier dialogue, bad acting, plus a slow-motion biblical orgy intercut with Neo and Trinity making love, you can almost see Cecil B. DeMille getting off in his grave. What went wrong? I think the Wachowskis have been pickling in their own self-importance for too long. When they made the original, they'd come off a terrific low-budget lesbian film noir called Bound, and they gave The Matrix a no-nonsense B-movie thrust. Here, almost every sequence goes on for too long, especially the climax, which is designed to look like the end of 2001 and seem just as cosmic. It does explode the biblical mumbo-jumbo that has preceded it, forcing us to rethink the meaning of the prophecies that have guided Neo's actions. But the knowledge isn't liberating this time, because the movie itself is so deadly. In the first Matrix, Neo broke through the artificial into the real. In The Matrix Reloaded, he breaks through into a really pretentious blockbuster with no transcendence in sight.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, fictional stories by Carl Yanyama. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an hour of gambling. We talk with Andy Bellin, author of Poker Nation. Also Kevin Conley, author of Stud, about the intimate and lucrative business of breeding racehorses. Join us for the next Fresh Air.